even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. On today's show, Richard Ford, on his latest novel, Be Mine. Richard Ford is the author of The Sports Writer, Independence Day, which won the Pulitzer Prize and the Penn Faulkner Award, The Lay of the Land, and the New York Times bestseller Canada. His short story collections include the bestseller Let Me Be Frank With You, Sorry For Your Trouble, Rock Springs, and A Multitude of Sins, which contain many widely anthologized stories. And today we're here to talk about Richard's latest book, which is Be Mine. Richard, welcome to Little Atoms.
Really nice to get to talk to you, Neil. It's a pleasure.
So Be Mine is the fifth book about the character Frank Bascom. So first of all, remind us something about who he is.
Well, Frank is in this book 70, I don't know, 5-6 years old. I used to know. And I've been writing about him, making him up, since he was 39 years old. And it has been the period of his middle life, right now out to his elderly life. Started off in the first book as a sports writer, a divorced man with three children, one of whom dies, and then he becomes an estate agent. And after that, retires from being an estate agent. And it's just really about a swath of American life that seems to me to be available to and accessible to and understandable by anybody. You don't have to be an American to get this man.
I think there's something particularly interesting about, because you know, the first book was The Sports Writer, and he starts off as a writer, but as you just said, spends most of his career as in real estate, as an estate agent. And I wanted to talk to you about looking at America through the prism of that industry, because it's something that obviously everybody needs a home, everybody loves their home, and yet, you know, the property market is often at the hard end of capitalism. We obviously had the subprime situation over there. There's been various property crashes. So tell me something about that choice to make him a real estate agent.
In the first book, I had him be a sports writer because that's something I knew something about and could populate the book as a vocation for him with all kinds of details and all kinds of things that I knew and that I thought were interesting and funny and also interesting enough to be taken seriously. But when I came around to write about him again, I didn't feel like I had the chops to make him be the same thing he was in the first book. I thought I had to make the second book be different. And so, because I knew a lot about what we call real estate in the United States, had been in lots of realtors' cars, had bought lots of houses and rented lots of houses and lived in lots of houses, I thought, well, because it's important to me for any character that I write to have a vocation that is plausible, I could make him be an estate agent because, as again, I knew a lot about it. And what I didn't anticipate was, which is what you are averring, that estate agents, real estate into home, becomes a lens right into the middle of the American experience, but in a poignant way, because as you say, where we live is everything to us in a way. It's where we will die. It's where our most poignant and important life events will occur. When we look out our windows and what we see is the nature of our lived life. And so, apart from that, too, there is just the whole economics of it, how real estate is a barometer to the national temper, How we feel and thrive or fail to thrive within the real estate market is a fairly good measure of our buoyancy.
Tell us again then where Frank is. You said he's semi-retired. So where do we find him at the beginning of this novel? What situation is he in?
At the beginning of this novel, he has retired from being an estate agent and is in his middle 70s with two children in his life who live elsewhere. He lives in central New Jersey in a little town I made up called Haddam, New Jersey, which is more or less in the area of where Princeton, New Jersey is. And he is working part-time for an old employer from his early realty days in a company which does, it's called House Whisperers. They actually find and sort of curate house sales to people who don't want their house sales to become public. They're a sort of organization that I made up, but I had an odd feeling that when I made it up, that I probably can't make it up. It probably already exists, or I wouldn't be able to make it up. So House Whisperers was my invention, but if it hasn't already occurred, it's occurring now. And in fact, on television in the United States, since I have been finishing this book in the last year, I have seen an ad for some organization in which some shady-looking guy standing on a street corner is the House Whisperer. So I thought, well, it makes my wife happy when I make up these things and the culture finally catches up with it. You know, you're doing something right.
So you mentioned that Frank has in the past, and this is the, you know, the plot of the sports writer, he's lost one of his sons, but his younger son, Paul, is a focus in this novel. And so tell us something about Paul and who he is.
Well, Paul is 47 years old, and he's a zany 47 years old because he's been in the other books as a zany 15-year-old and as a zany 30-year-old. He's not on the spectrum. We don't think he's on the spectrum. He's not that kind of zaniness, but he's just a changeling. He's just an exceptional, perfectly functioning, perfectly plausible, weird guy. And I liked making him up immensely because probably of all these characters, I was, as a young boy, more like Paul than I was like anybody. Very language addicted, not terribly rational, a little bit on the outs, though he's more on the outs than I was. But and he has amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. Oh, by the way, he has Lou Gehrig's disease, or as you would say in Britain, he has motor neuron disease and is going to die.
So what is that? Tell us a bit more about what ALS, or as Paul calls it, OWLS, which is very amusing, like it's a bar. What is ALS? What does it do? Well, what's it going to do to him?
It is a breakdown of the motor neurons in the back of your skull. And its effect is that the signals that it sends out to the muscles in your body, particularly your appendages, but ultimately all of your muscles, those messages begin to be occluded, and then they begin to be blocked so that what you have is not only muscle atrophy, but muscle death. And then over time, sometimes it can be a relatively short time, a year. Sometimes it can last for 20 years as your muscles gradually stop being functioning. And then ultimately, because the muscles in your that allow for you to breathe also die, and you drown, basically, if you're unlucky. If you're lucky, you get hit by a truck someplace.
And as the novel starts, Paul is just coming to the end of a program at a hospital, a sort of experimental program. Tell us something about that.
Well, he has this experimental program at the Great Mayo Clinic, which is in Rochester, Minnesota, and is the sort of top of the heat in the healthcare industry. It's the great place that anybody who could go would go. And Paul goes there because Frank has been there in a previous book that I wrote called The Lay of the Land when he had prostate cancer. And so because Frank's old girlfriend, Catherine Flaherty, is a physician in La Jolla, California, she is able to get Paul into this experimental drug program, which will not cure him, which will only allow him to be, he feels, useful for subsequent generations of people with ALS. And so he engages in this program knowing that it won't help him, which is a kind of wonderful, in his case, irony. Because what he needs is for somebody to cure him. And the one thing the Mayo Clinic, this great curative institution in the heart of America, can't do for him is cure him.
So that's the answer then to why Rochester. I was going to ask, because in the main, the novels are, I mean, not entirely set, but let's say based, because often there are road trips and that's something else we'll come to. But in the main sets, as you've already mentioned, in New Jersey, this one is based. They are based at the beginning of the novel in Minnesota. So that's why. But Right. Tell us something more about this setting in particular, Minnesota.
Well, it takes place in Rochester, Minnesota, which is where the Mayo Clinic actually resides, which is this gigantic institution of many, many buildings in the heart of basically the cold zone of America. And this is in the middle of February, so it's particularly cold there. It is an iconic institution which kind of consumes the town of Rochester. And it's to there that Paul and Frank go, and they reside in a flip house, which is owned by Frank's employer, who happens to be a Tibetan named Mike Mahoney back in New Jersey. So it's got a New Jersey tie, the book does. And then they go there and they stay in this flip house until Frank's, till Paul's time at the clinic is over. And then they strike out because Frank wants to do something for Paul to celebrate his graduation from this program. They go to Mount Rushmore, which is not close by, but on the other side of the state of South Dakota, which you can drive to from Rochester, Minnesota in about 10 hours, a short American trip.
Tell us something more about you. You mentioned that Paul is zany. I love the fact that he is a ventriloquist. But also in this book, he's developed an obsession with the obscure 1960s singer Anthony Newley.
Yes.
Tell me something about that.
Well, I am fascinated by Anthony Newley. I am sort of fascinated by his person, his persona, his singing voice, the fact that he was so multi-talented as a writer of songs. He wrote Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, which was a huge Broadway smash, and was for me a kind of just natively compelling character to watch sing and be on the stage. And I got fascinated by him, as David Bowie was, by the way. David Bowie actually completely mimicked Tony Newley in developing his own singing style and voice. So I just thought, gee, I'm interested in Tony Newley. Wouldn't it be interesting if Paul was interested in Tony Newley? And then I could use what I knew to kind of people the fascination that he has. It's also, you know, this novel is a comedy about a very dark subject. So I just thought being fascinated by Anthony Newley was hilarious.
I was literally going to raise David Bowie because when you listen to early David Bowie,
absolutely,
it's so obvious that he is just copying Anthony Newley, and it's a real revelation when you find that out.
And he completely admits it. He's completely cool with it. I loved it about him. I remember the first time I heard David Bowie was in 1974 at the University of Michigan, because one of my colleagues there was doing a PhD in, I don't know, something, I think rock music. It was in those early days when you could do a PhD in fucking anything. And she played David Bowie on her little recorder. And I said, her name is Denise Blue. I said, Denise, I said, he sounds just like Anthony Newley. And she was so hot about that. She just seemed so insulted that I would say that the great David Bowie sounded like Anthony Newley. That's exactly who he sounds like, as you say, in his early days. And later in the Ziggy Stardust days, he doesn't anymore. He didn't, you know, if you know anything about David Bowie, and you obviously do, he had a hell of a time getting started. He just almost could never get any traction. And one of the reasons was that he couldn't sing very well.
Yeah, that's incredible. Now, nobody would have that chance nowadays to just have a career of failure and failure and failure and then suddenly. I mean, that's the same in writing as well, obviously, you know. It's all about the debut novel nowadays, you know what I mean?
Is
nobody gets to write three or four novels until they get into their stride.
Yeah, nobody gives you a chance to fail anymore. I mean, when I was a young novelist, I mean, my first two books didn't fail, but they also didn't really succeed other than to get published. They didn't find a lot of readers. And nobody held a gun to my head at that time. Now these poor kids, they publish a debut novel and everybody wants them to be famous. And then the second book comes along and it's a little different from the first book and boop, they're gone. It's wrong.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Richard Ford, and we're talking about his latest novel, Be Mine. And Richard, back to Frank. And Frank is very much what the young people today pejoratively would call a boomer. Like his, like...
Is that a pejorative term now, G?
Nowadays it is, yeah. Because
you can be dissed for just being born from when you were born.
The idea of a character like Frank, or, you know, his literary contemporaries like, you know, Rabbit Angstrom, are people that grew up in an America that never had it so good, you know, and they benefited from, although they live these lives of, you know, various divorces and strife and everything, they live in an America that was prosperous. And nowadays, this book is set in a very different America. Frank is commenting on America. That's much more fractured, much less prosperous than it was, than the America as he was growing up was.
But much more diverse and much more successfully diverse.
Mm-hmm. But nonetheless fractured. And we see, the first time we see Donald Trump in this novel, there's a fantastic little sketch of the man from Frank. And yeah, I just wanted to talk about that, like Frank's view of contemporary America, I guess.
Well, I don't think he has a view any more than I have a view, which is to say that it's a received experience. You get your view of America from news media of all sorts, but you also have to factor in what the news media tell you within the framework of your own lived life and observable experience. I mean, it's one of the reasons why this book is only partways political, though it is partways political, but only. I didn't want to populate the political side of this book with just a bunch of received news bites that everybody else already knows. I had to have it be what a person actually will notice when he's driving around, which is to say that he sees cars that have both a Trump and a Biden sticker on the back. He sees yard art throughout the whole nation, which is that America is a country that doesn't like government, but thrives on politics as a sort of a substitute TV show. I mean, there's almost no place in America that you can go that somebody isn't running for office, and these yard stickers are up on everybody's yard. But somehow nobody likes government. They want government to stay the hell out of their business, but they want to be voting and not voting and having opinions about political events and politicians all the time. They're addicted to politics, but they hate government, which I think is just really odd and funny, really.
We talked already about the real estate market, and at the time I forgot to ask you about Mike. You brought up Frank's former partner, now boss, Mike, who's a wonderful character who has featured through numerous books. So tell us a little bit more about Mike.
Well, Mike Mahoney is a Tibetan, and his actual name is Lobsang Dargi, but Frank understands that when Mike was first in this country, as happens to many immigrants, all of his colleagues decided to give him a name that they could pronounce, which was to give him an Irish name, Mike Mahoney. So he goes from being Lobsang Dargi to becoming Mike Mahoney. And then in the process, he finds a sort of purchase in life in New Jersey and divorces his Tibetan wife and marries an elderly Jewish woman and becomes rich in the real estate market by selling distressed seaside real estate, which is, of course, what happens all the time in the United States, only not to Tibetans.
And I wanted you to say something about the various women in Frank's life over the years. And indeed, there's a new character in this book, Betty, who he meets. So tell us something about the various women in his life.
Well, Betty, particularly Betty Tran, is an American of Vietnamese heritage. She is the granddaughter of people who were American cooperatives in the 60s in Vietnam and who escaped. And she's grown up in central Minnesota, where a lot of immigrants do grow up with a sort of a American purchase on life, even though she's fully Vietnamese, at least genetically. And then she is a massage therapist. And while Frank is waiting for Paul to go through his everyday treatments, he is so sort of overwrought by what's happening to his son that he sees an ad in a newspaper and decides that he will go get a massage. And in this massage establishment, which is in Rochester, he meets Betty Tran, who is his massage therapist, and he falls in love with her, which I thought would be outrageous and would probably get me in a lot of trouble that some old white guy writing about a young Vietnamese massage therapist would just be too much for a lot of people. But it's turned out not to bother anybody at all, which proves, I guess, something about how much I understand about what's going on in the culture, because it didn't seem to care. Nobody seemed to care. Even the sensitivity at it, which I had to experience and endure at HarperCollins in the United States, I thought, oh, this is going to get me in a lot of trouble. All I'm going to hear is it says, you have to take this out of your book. But nobody said a word.
So what was your experience of that like then? Because that sensitivity editing is something that is a bit of a hot potato at the moment. But, you know, to me, it seems like just an extension of research. You know, if you're writing a book about a historical period, one would expect you to do the research on that thing. So how have you found the experience of, I guess, having somebody else look at your work for that purpose?
Somebody else who doesn't know much, by the way. Well, I think in Britain, the sensitivity edit is probably a little more rife upon the world than it has come to be in the United States. 2 years ago, when I published a book of stories, I really had a lot of, as I think the word is, pushback from the sensitivity editors. 2 years later, when I'm publishing now Be Mine, a lot of those issues have subsided and people don't seem to care as much about them as they did 2 years ago, which lets you know just exactly how profound that sensitivity actually was. It was just all about money and the publishers ducking before they were hit. Nobody has who does these sensitivity edits, as far as I can tell, in my own experience, and I have two experiences in it. Nobody has any conviction about this. They're just trying not to get in trouble in such a way that it would cost the publishers some money. But what I did was I just put into the book everything I wanted to put into the book, without much thought that somebody was going to come along and tell me to take some stuff out. But I did leave in some things purposefully that I knew would attract their attention so that they would maybe be able to feel good about getting me to take some things out and that I would agree to take out, because I didn't give a shit anyway. So I just left those things in. Then I took them out. And so all the things that I really cared about, I got to leave in. I mean, you have to try to deal with your editor's own predilections, you know.
Happiness is one of the themes of the books is happiness. And I guess the way that our idea of what happiness is and what can be attained changes throughout our lifetime and as one gets old. So tell me something about the theme of happiness in the novel.
Well, it goes way back to The Sports Writer. When I started to write The Sports Writer, I said to my wife, I think I'm going to try to write a novel about a man who's a sports writer. I said, do you have any thoughts about this? I'm always asking my wife if she has any thoughts about things, and I wish she had more. It would help me out, but she helps me a lot. She said, well, what I would do if I were you, she said, is rather than do what you have been doing for the past two novels, in which very few people read, why don't you write a book about somebody who's happy for a change? And so that kind of put me on to the trail of happiness right from the beginning. How are you able to generate a sense in your own heart and in your imagination that you are happy? And I don't just mean happy like Disneyland happy or happy like Christmas morning or an ice cream cone. I mean happy in such a way that faces all the inevitabilities and realities of your life so that it really, happiness has real traction in your life. So that has carried me through writing all of these books. And since this is the last of these books, I thought I would make that be the central premise of the book. How does one, in the face of the death of one's surviving son, emerge at the end of the book able to say, I'm happy? Because I think that's one of the things that will allow us to survive, if surviving, in fact, is what we want to do.
And just one more thing, and then I'll ask you to read a bit of the book for us, if you would. As I said, there are five books based around Frank Bascom, and all of these books also have, I guess, as a sort of organizing principle, they're all set around a holiday or a significant date. This one's set around Valentine's Day, which is not a holiday, but a significant date in the calendar. So I just wanted to talk about why you chose to do that.
Well, for a very practical reason, because I thought if I set a book on the 4th of July or on Thanksgiving, which you don't even probably have in Britain, or big national holidays, Easter, that when the typical American reader reads it, she or he will have memories which are then invocable for that particular time, so that a novel which is set at that period will have a kind of recognizability and also a palpable emotional environment to it. We all know how we feel when we all know how Easter feels. We all know how in America Thanksgiving feels. We all know how Valentine's feels. So it was just a ploy to try to make the book to a reader recognizable and plausible emotionally.
Let's finish it off. Can I get you to read us a bit?
Lately, I've begun to think more than I used to about happiness. This is not an idle consideration at any time in life, but it is a high-dollar bonus topic for me, born 1945, approaching my stipulated biblical alignment. Being an historical Presbyterian, not attending, not believing like most Presbyterians, I've passed easily through life, observing a version of happiness old Knox himself might have approved, walking the fine line between the twinned injunctions that say, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger, and happiness is whatever is not bludgeoning unhappiness. The second being more Augustinian, though all these complex systems get you to the same mystery. Do what now? This median path has worked fairly well through most situations life has flung my way, a gradual, sometimes unnoticed succession through time, without anything great happening, though nothing unsurvivable, and most of it quite okay. The grievous death of my first son, I have one other. Divorce, twice. I've had cancer, my parents have died, my first wife has also died. I've been shot in the chest with an AR-15 and nearly died myself, but improbably didn't. I've lived through hurricanes and what some might say was depression. It was mild, if it was depression at all. Nothing, however, has sent me spiraling to the bottom, so that cashing in my own chips seemed like a good idea. Much quite good contemporary literature, which I read in bed, and if I angle the page right, is all about just such matters, with happiness ever elusive, but still the goal. Yet,
I'm not sure if happiness is the most important state for all of us to aspire to. There are statistics on these subjects, graduate degrees, fields of study offering grants, a think tank at UCLA. Happiness apparently declines in most adults through their 30s and 40s, bottoming out in the early 50s, then sometimes starting up again in the 70s, though it's not a sure thing. Knowing what you fear in life may be a more useful measure and skill set. When asked by an interviewer, "Do you feel you could have been happier in life?" the poet Larkin said, "No, not without being someone else. Though purely on average, I would say I've been happy. Happy enough, at least, to be Frank Bascom and not someone else. And until late days, that has been more than satisfactory for getting along. Recently, however, since my surviving son, Paul Bascom, who's 47, became sick and presenting well-distinguished symptoms of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, though there's speculation the Iron Horse really didn't have it but had something else, the subject of happiness has required more of my attention."
So I've been talking to Richard Ford. We've been talking about his new novel, Be Mine, which is out now in the UK from Bloomsbury. Richard, thank you so much for taking the time to tell me about it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for doing it.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced, presented, and edited by me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is hosted by Acast and published by 89UP. The show is broadcast on Mondays and Saturdays on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.